Well, Bill Jovov, thanks for joining.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
So, Bill, for the audience, maybe talk a little bit about what you do for MFS, how long you've been doing it.
Oh, well, so I've been fortunate enough to be here 30 years. Actually, March 4th was my 30th anniversary.
You're old.
Yes. Seasoned veteran.
There we go.
I'm in the retail wholesale.
Okay.
So I'm a wholesaler in the Los Angeles area, so I get to call on the wirehouses and independents and represent MFS funds in separate accounts and 401ks and just work with some great advisors.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you. So for additional context, you and I were talking, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 weeks ago, and as we do often, and you were asking me some questions, and one of us, I can't remember if it was you or I, said, well, that would be a good idea for a podcast.
Yeah.
So we're going to do something a little bit different from what we do in these normal podcasts where I'm going to play the role as the guest, and you're going to play the role as the host. No, we're going to try to emulate maybe some of the conversations you and I have had, and hopefully folks will find this interesting.
Sounds like a plan, yeah.
Okay. So if you're maybe, if you were to summarize the mood, the sentiment of financial advisors today, maybe we'll start there. What are people worried about, or what are some of the common questions you get?
You know, the common questions always fall into the categories of what we're trying to suggest is that there's questions on the equities, there's questions on international, there's questions obviously on interest rates, and there's always questions surrounding on are we going to have a soft landing, a hard landing, and how all this transpires and what we're trying to do as, you know, mutual fund wholesalers. And I think the biggest topic of conversation for the last year has really been, are interest rates going to come down? Are we going into in a soft landing? Is it time to move money out of treasuries or CDs or these higher yielding money markets and extend duration?
Yeah.
And then it feels like every time that it looks like a good idea, immediately rates don't do what people think they're going to do.
It gets pushed off.
It gets kicked down the pike a little bit. And, you know, we still have to show people all the history of perhaps it's better to be early than to be late when you're moving money and extending duration. But, you know, the clients have to be convinced, or they have to feel right about it, and the financial advisor has to feel right about it.
Okay. As it pertains to the economy, soft landing, and I guess interest rates, I tend to think that investors, not just clients, not just financial advisors, but the public by and large, I feel tend to conflate these things. In other words, soft landing, recession, interest rates down, equities down, or soft landing, interest rates lower, bond prices up. And oftentimes, I think sometimes we tangle these things up, and like where you sit or where you stand is a function of where you sit. So your perspective is obviously built upon your experience. And as you and I have talked about a lot, and as I've tried to written and communicate, that in the last 15 years, but even our entire career, you know, I've been doing this as, almost as long as you, I'm not sure that's going to be the best predictor of the next 5, 10 to 20 years. Because the factors that drove returns, and we can get into this if you like, if you think worthwhile, I think have changed dramatically, specifically the artificial suppression of interest rates and globalization. Those were the two biggest factors of returns globally, and both of those have changed materially. So in other words, I wonder if the investor, they're seeking the right answers to the wrong questions.
Yeah, there's always a sense of, to get the conversation started, almost like when you meet somebody and you go, well, how are you doing? You know, do they really care how you're doing? Yeah. Or is it just a nice way to get a conversation starter going?
Yeah.
So generally in our industry, people want to know, so what's MFS thinking about interest rates, recession, soft landing, hard landing? Whether that really relates to anything that they're talking to their clients about, it seems most just want to start the conversation with that. So that's why it's important that we have that, I don't want to call it opinion.
Point of view.
Point of view. That's why we want to have that point of view.
You need to have an answer.
Right. Yeah. You need to have an answer. Nobody's going to check on you.
Yeah.
But they just want to see that process of how did you, why does MFS come to that conclusion or that point of view?
Yeah.
Or not even a conclusion, but a point of view. And then that can lead into what we're doing as an investment company.
Yeah, like better conversations.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Is there an overarching obstacle that they're facing or you're facing in trying to answer something?
Just they don't like to be incorrect.
Okay.
So when it comes to topics of, like we said, are interest rates going to come down and is it time to increase duration? I want to be right, like
yeah,
sooner than later. My opinion on international, I want to be right.
International equity.
Investing in international equities. I want to be right.
Yeah.
I don't want to feel like I'm making the wrong decision.
So maybe let's start there. So my travels the last few weeks, which admittedly have been largely institutional and largely U.S. institutional, so pension plans, endowments, et cetera. So they have the same job, the same function as the folks that you're calling on, but their levers or their time horizon might differ a little bit, but directionally the same. And a question, I guess maybe call it a complaint, that I heard throughout was international equities. And I think, would you echo that? I think I've heard that from you before.
Yeah, we generally hear from the FAs, they understand the concept of allocation and how, you know, globalization and international equities should be a great part of an investment portfolio.
Yeah.
But they feel often that it's underperformed for their liking.
Yeah. For a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I've been hearing from the institutional. In fact, I heard from two, which I was surprised at, that they're leaning towards giving it up altogether.
I've also heard that from time to time.
Yeah, which is pretty extreme. Yeah. Maybe taking a step back, you know, fundamentals, what a company does, how do they do it, that drives return on capital, i.e. the profitability of an enterprise. And that drives asset prices. So, you know, hindsight's 2020, and the U.S. has outperformed the rest of the world in a material manner because profits outperformed in a material manner. And I think I can appreciate the disappointment that investors have because of that experience. But if you take a step back, it's not the way it's always been, right? So coming out of the technology bubble in the late 90s, where U.S. outperformed, from when that business cycle ended in the early 2000 up until the GFC, that 7-8 year time frame was very different. Mm-hmm. Right? So non-U.S. equities or international equities materially out-earned U.S. equities. There was a commodity super cycle happening. China was growing rapidly. International companies just have more profitability beta, if you will,
Absolutely. To
commodities and to economic growth. So international equities, or international stocks, excuse me, were out-earning U.S., which is why the MSCI EAFE was outperforming the S&P 500. Then the correction of the global financial crisis, it wasn't just banks. It was over-earning non-U.S. enterprises. And then it flipped.
It flipped.
Right? For the last 15 years. And so I think, well, at least what I try to impart is, you know, just go back to what matters for future asset price. Of course, it's valuation, but largely who's going to out-earn, or rather, which segment was over-earning, because that's likely where the next correction is going to stem from.
And hasn't that generally been a good thesis of who was over-earning and then it leads to a correction?
So as you mentioned at the top, one of the catalysts for our discussion that we want to try to recapture today is akin to, you know, why U.S. has outperformed non-U.S. It's about profits. Similarly, at a sector level, right, you see this too, where investors are always gravitating towards industries with higher returns and they're pulling capital from industries with lower returns. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of capitalism. And you've seen that with technology stocks. So yes, while you have some momentum and perhaps excessive valuation in certain segments of the U.S. market, particularly the growth market, particularly technology, but underneath that, there's expectations of earning strength and earning superiority. So, you know, akin to why U.S. has outperformed non-U.S., akin to why technology has outperformed everything else, it ultimately all comes back to earnings and profits. And then the question really is, well, what's the sustainability of that? Because volatility is just simply the market adjusting for assumptions that were wrong, Right, and we've seen this before. Sure. You saw incorrect assumptions in the 90s. You saw incorrect assumptions about banking leverage in the 2000s. And I think you're seeing some excessive assumptions today in certain parts of technology.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you also had mentioned that even the some of the variables, like the cost of running a business, is becoming excessive.
Yeah.
You want to touch upon that a little bit?
So really simple. Fundamentals drive earnings. Earnings drive stock prices. Period. And in the last 15 years, you've had two major factors that drove what was all-time high, like literally all-time high profitability. So maybe to take a step back, from 2009 to 2020, you had one of the weakest business cycles since the U.S. Civil War. Not one of, excuse me, it was the weakest.
So say that one more time.
So the post-global financial crisis business cycle, so 11 years, really long. GDP was consistent but very low. Inflation was consistent but very low. Growth was consistent and very low. No money velocity, very low level of lending, very low level of spending. Economists call that secular stagnation. That broke during COVID because of stimulus. But the overarching point, to kind of take a step back, 30,000 foot view, you had one of the weakest business expansions or cycles in 150 years, yet profitability, particularly in the United States, reached all-time highs.
Now, do you attribute that to inflation where prices were going up?
No, this is before that.
Before that.
Yeah, so this is by 2018.
Okay. Yeah.
So by 2018, profits hit all-time highs. And this gets to your original question, so why? How? Like, how did that happen? It's really, really simple. So profits are functions of revenues and costs. Revenues are a function of how many pairs of glasses do you sell multiplied by the price.
Right.
Pretty simple. Cost is your cost of running the business, which you asked about. Revenues have a directional correlation, I would argue this cause and effect, with GDP. So when GDP is high, revenue growth is usually pretty high. When GDP is low, revenue growth is usually
low.
Makes sense. What you saw in the 2010s was not just below average economic growth, but below average revenue growth. It was 2%.
Yeah, very low.
Yeah. So you don't have to have a CFA to do a little simple arithmetic and say, okay, well, if you have tremendous profitability and it's not coming from economic growth and revenue and pricing power and inflation, it has to be coming through costs, to your question.
Mm-hmm.
So what was driving costs down? Two biggest factors. One was interest rates. So as coming out of the GFC, as consumers were borrowing less and spending less, as banks were lending less, as companies were spending less, interest rates were coming down. So it allowed businesses to borrow at cheap rates and then recycle that capital back in form of dividends, buybacks, acquisitions, et cetera. That was one.
Okay.
The other lever was globalization. Just-in-time delivery. Now, the prerequisite for just-in-time delivery or globalization, if you just think about it in simple terms, you and I are running a business, and we want to minimize the amount of inventory we have because inventorying something is expensive. You got to pay for the rent and shipping, all that stuff. But if we can get a good or service on demand or have it available for the customer just when they need it, we can reduce costs. But the prerequisite for that is a safe world.
Sure.
A world where shipping lanes are safe, a world where the globalization, the supply chain mechanism is running like a well-oiled machine.
And without excess costs like fuel or
supply
chain issues.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. So fast forward to today, right? Mm-hmm. So the pandemic hits, we had the stimulus response to it, you got the inflation response to it, but at the same time, you've got a hot war in Europe, conflict in the Middle East, Cold War between the U.S. and China. The world isn't as safe as a place it used to be.
Doesn't feel like it.
No. Yeah. And companies, I don't want to say came to the realization, what was exposed was the fragility of not having a good when you need it. To kind of put this in context, it takes 30,000 parts to make an automobile. That's a lot of...
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's a
when
lot
you think
of
about
parts,
that.
Yeah. And automotive companies have some of the most, now I'm cherry picking, because they have some of the most complex supply chains in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular sources goods over 60 countries, has over 1,200 or 1,300 different trading suppliers for 30,000 parts, all to make a car or a truck as cheap as possible. So back to your original question, costs were so low, I'd argue, because of deflation, the interest rate suppression brought by central banks, as well as globalization. And what I think not enough investors are maybe concerning themselves with today is, well, that changed, right? What changed now is interest rates are at...
They're higher.
They're higher. Yeah. And my pushback on clients is, well, when they say, well, interest rates are going to go lower, maybe the market will decide that.
Right.
Not a central banker, right? That era is gone now. You can push interest rates to zero when the cost of goods is cheap. My mother, hope she's not listening. She probably is, but she can't afford food.
Oh, wow.
I actually have two mothers. I have a biological and a mother-in-law, and I subsidize both.
Right, because, and that's a harsh reality.
Yeah, prescriptions, food, health, things, shelter, things that you have to buy are really, or still expensive, things that you don't have to buy are deflating. So it gets back to, I think, the cost of running your business or a business, it's just going to be a lot higher than it was in the last 15 years.
Which generally affects... revenue,
Profits,
right? Yeah. So the revenue's coming in, but it affects profits.
Yeah, which gets back to, again, it all keeps coming back to investing. When you talk about, you know, or clients talking about U.S. versus non-U.S. sectors, I think the simple playbook, which has been, oh, here's what has worked, U.S. or non-U.S., tech over everything else. Keep in mind, this came against a backdrop of artificially suppressed interest rates and a fully functional globalized world because of U.S. hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying globalization ended, but it's changed now. It's materially more expensive and more risky to have your supply chain sourced out of Asia.
So what's interesting when we were having this conversation prior to this conversation was, you know, a few things that that stuck with me is a few quotes from you, if I will.
Okay,
so you said the environment's going to be different because the cost of capital went from cheap to expensive, and you just eloquently talked about that, right?
Yeah.
And then the other part was the cost of running a business went up a lot. So you just also talked about, you know, how our company is going to work on that. Maybe we can lean that into building a mutual fund or looking at companies about that. And then last was, you know, this environment may wash out businesses that can't afford to stay in business.
Yep.
Capital labor costs are expensive and cheaper scarcity value. And that kind of all plays into the conversation you just had.
Yeah, so kind of bring it all back. Let's just pretend for a moment, and you and I have talked about this at other points in the past, which is pretend there's no S&P 500.
Okay.
Pretend there's not an index. Pretend there's not an ETF, pretend there isn't mutual funds and financial markets.
It's just companies.
It's just companies, right? And you're deciding to invest in this company. And maybe to make it even simpler, the world is comprised of savers and borrowers. And now the reality is you and I are both savers and borrowers. You might have a car loan or a mortgage or credit card loans, but you also have savings or investment.
Correct.
So in simple terms, there's an equilibrium in society between savers and borrowers. So when there's more savers than, and I say borrowers, people who have an idea, a business plan, but they need capital to put it forward, right? So that's what investing is. And the return on that project or their idea needs to supersede or be better than what you would get at savings rates. And of course, it needs to be commensurate with the risk, et cetera, et cetera. But for the last 15 years, when you pushed interest rates to the zero bound, now it made everything investable. It made everything fungible, if you will, right?
Absolutely.
Something that might not have been a good idea 20 years ago was a good idea in 2017. But my larger point is that projects, businesses get funded when society decides it's worth funding, right? And they pull that funding either from savings or from other companies. And that's how you get a capitalism, an efficient market, et cetera. And largely now, I think what's different is the cost of funding went up a lot, right? It went from being abundant and cheap to, let's call it, scarce and a bit more expensive. Labor went from being abundant and cheap because of globalization to now being scarce and expensive.
Yeah.
Goods, shipping, etc. Shipping costs are up dramatically just year to date.
Mm-hmm.
Commodity prices. So all of
were shipping costs up prior to the challenge we're having in the Middle East?
No. So put some numbers behind
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And this all kind of triangulates back to post-World War II, mm-hmm. Bretton Woods. Really, it was an agreement, if you will, that the U.S. naval power would police the seas and make it a safe and cheap place, the world, to do business, a global alliance, if you will. So the cost of a container, a can on a big ship, has deflated massively over the years to, I don't know, like $600-$800. It's just such a small part of cost. It's still small,
mm-hmm.
but it's going up.
It's going up.
And in addition, now you're shifting supply chains to countries where there's maybe less geopolitical risk or where it's closer to home. That requires people. It requires people with different skill sets that they might not possess. All of this costs more. So bring it back to your point about how to build a mutual fund, if you will. I just come back to nothing's changed. What matters is fundamentals drive profits, profits drive asset prices. I think what's changed now is the ease of generating an ROI just went up. It just went down.
Right.
It got a lot harder. So we need to be more thoughtful and more careful. I say we mean the collective investor universe, about who you're lending money to or who you're giving your capital to, because the ROI that you're expecting might not be what it was the last 5, 6, 7 years. And that price of that asset that, you know, price is what you pay, value is what you get.
Right.
The price is really high, the value might be a lot lower.
Which nobody likes.
Nobody
really likes that. Yeah, so again, it's an environment of looking at companies that can just have better earnings,
yeah.
better return on investment, return on capital. Yeah, meet expectations.
Yeah.
So.
And I know that, you know, that comes across as so self-serving. Right? We're active managers,
mm-hmm.
And I've been saying this for years. But if you just keep it really simple, which I think hopefully we've done here this morning, the operating environment has changed. And I just think that, you know, as a world, as an investor world, we've been operating in an environment of interest rate suppression and cheap labor
mm-hmm.
and shipping costs. And both those things changed dramatically in the last 12 to 24 months. Now, what we haven't talked about is AI and how that affects that. And we can get into that if you'd like. And I don't dispute that AI isn't a or won't be a step function changing technology. It's going to make us all more productive and efficient. And I subscribe to that. I don't see how it can. But it might make a good business better.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to make a bad business good.
Got it.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you have a product or service and you're competing against someone else who has a product or service, and their product or service is, let's say, a little bit better, the ROI of those two companies has probably been very similar the last 10, 15 years for all the reasons we've talked
mm-hmm.
about. Fast forward to today, the better company, they still have higher borrowing costs. They're paying more for people. They're struggling too, but AI is going to help them be better.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the weaker company, just in my hypothetical, it's not going to help them get better, but they're still going to have the same struggle. So kind of to your point that you mentioned earlier in one of the quotes, this should, I think, accelerate the narrative that we're talking about here today, which is better companies with better returns get a scarcity premium in risk markets.
You know, AI, it's always an interesting conversation because some industries may be affected negatively dramatically.
Yeah.
And then it could benefit other sectors or industries over the moon, if you will, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and I think sometimes we have to get used to the fact that, you know, even when the personal computer came out, you know, you could sit there and say, well, that's going to destroy the typewriter industry.
Yep.
But look at the benefits of not destroying an industry or watching an industry go away. But that cycle's been around since the beginning of time.
Yeah. No, you saw this with accounting. So, you know, when Excel came out and other types of tax package, it didn't displace accountants. It just created more because tax reporting accounting just got more complicated. So you were able to do more. So I'm not sure. I have no idea, really, what this is going to do to the labor markets.
Right.
Does it displace jobs, et cetera? And that's not our focus here, right? Our focus is if a company is – if the market is signaling based upon the price of the stock that a company's going to have an 8% ROI, our job is, with all these factors that we talked about, are they going to be able to deliver 8, 9, 10, or is it going to be 7, 6,
it's 5,
right? And that's going to matter, I think, a lot more than it has.
And these periods of, I guess, transition, if you will, you know, interest rates were zero, now they're higher, we're not quite sure where GDP is, inflation is, how long rates are going to stay at these levels, the importance of understanding what your what a company is doing as far as ROI, ROC, becomes ever more important.
Yeah, far more. Yeah. Maybe should we talk about fixed income interest rates since you just mentioned that?
Sure. Why not?
So just something that I think, because you mentioned earlier at the top about expectation of interest rates coming down and getting pushed off and pushed off and pushed off because of the inflation data. You know, perhaps, so going from 9% inflation to 3 or whatever the delta was, right? I'm not an economist, but that was easy. Some of that was comps and some of that was just the stimulus fading. But I'm not sure we get back to the inflationary levels that maybe central bankers think, or maybe the market thinks that they think, just because of some pretty significant structural dynamics here, right? The globalization, the deglobalization, or however you want to think about it, onshoring, friendshoring, shortage of labor, that's inflationary. Demographics is inflationary. You're going to have more consumers and less producers.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty simple. And so I just wonder, are fixed income allocations by clients, are they built based upon a narrative that may not come true, which is one that, well, interest rates going to go back to where they were. And I'm not sure you're going to see that.
And as always, nobody rings a bell to tell us.
Right.
So, yeah. So that seems to be the overarching question or concern when you're talking about fixed rates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would you say a lot of the decision is the decision tree for a financial advisor, I'm going to increase my fixed income risk budget largely because I think rates are going to go lower, or I think the central bank's going to cut rates. Would you say, is that the catalyst?
Well, the catalyst is, it seems inevitable that may happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be prepared, but I don't want to jump in with both feet.
Yeah.
You know, that seems, I want to be strategic about moving money out of the current, you know, safe rate, if you will, the treasury rate or CD rate or a higher yielding money market, and then extending duration. But I don't want to be too early, and I certainly don't want to be late.
Yeah.
So it's a...
Yeah. Well, full disclosure, we're overweight fixed income versus equities in portfolios that I work on.
Mm-hmm.
So we've made that commitment, right? So I think fixed income is more attractive than equities given potential risk-adjusted returns. But it's not built on this foundation that central banks are going to cut rates, because I'm not sure, or I don't believe that they're going to cut rates maybe like how the market thinks or how people...
Or we thought going into this year.
Yeah. And just put it in really simple terms, you know, every risk asset, stocks, bonds, et cetera, has a risk premium, right? The expected return over treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, treasuries have a risk premium too. They don't call it that. They call it term premium. So one reason why rates were so low in the 2010s, it was not just central banks suppressing the short end of the curve and then the long end through quantitative easing. They were doing it because money velocity was so low, inflation velocity or inflation vol was so low, which drives term. So if you know year in, year out, high certainty that a dollar today is going to be worth a dollar tomorrow, the term premium is going to be pretty low. So fast forward to today. I bet if we got, you know, 50 of your clients in a room, maybe half of them would say rates would be a little bit higher, or half would say rates would be a little bit lower. There'd be a more mixed view.
Sure.
And I think that's a function of just the uncertainty. And so if you have more uncertainty regarding inflation, you should have more uncertainty regarding rates, and it should be a higher term premium. So just given, I guess, that framework,
yeah,
I think maybe we should caution folks on how much rates could fall.
And I think we've done a good job at that. Yeah. I think we've done a good job at just making sure that there is a – the position is we have to be more – it's a more educated and listen.
Yeah. So, and I'll let you go. Is there anything we haven't covered or something that you want clients to know or something you want the listeners to know that your clients are telling you that you think is important?
I think if we could almost summarize, it seems like we talked a lot about earnings and because of cost of goods and services and labor going up, that we have to be more cognitive about companies, how their earnings and profits are being looked at going forward from here. It's not as, I don't want to say easy, it's just not as clear cut as it was.
It's just going to be more acute.
More acute. As far as, you know, international versus U.S., you know, how are you looking at that as a summarized point?
Sure. I hear often sometimes a valuation argument being made, and I don't dismiss that. I think that's, but U.S. should always be more expensive than non-U.S., so start there, right? So the United States respects property rights more so than any other country. You have greater labor mobility, so you can take your company, pick up, move it from state A to state B with lower taxes, cheaper labor, et cetera. It's harder to do that in Asia, harder to do that in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to source capital here, which is the best functioning capital markets. So for that reason, U.S. companies tend to have an earnings premium, and therefore you get a valuation premium. But just the extremis of valuation, it's too high. So international, to me, you're getting a not only a valuation discount, but more importantly, all those things that we talked about of capital costs and the cost of running your business, non-U.S. companies, I think, have less to give back.
Okay.
Right? U.S. companies were taking advantage of that far more so than other countries. So, yeah, labor costs fell in Europe. Shipping costs fell. They're both going up, but not up as much as they are
here.
Right. So I think you've got a fundamental story at your back outside the United States, and you got a valuation story.
Which has always been the overarching story anyway.
Yeah. You
know, or historically.
Yeah.
And then you talked about rates, and it's a game of I don't want to call it a waiting game, but we have to see what's going on and what's happening.
Well, I think we just need to reset our expectations, right? Yeah. So I think fixed income is attractive here, not because rates are going to go materially lower, but because I don't think there's catalyst for them to go higher.
So fundamentals just seem to be ever more important now than...
Yeah.
Than,
and I think they always have been, but it was blunted by a massive, massive wave of cost suppression,
right?
Rates and globalization. Yep. And so it's always mattered, but now the market, there's going to be greater dispersion. Profit dispersion, if you will. So it's been pretty tight where outside of a few, maybe Magnificent Seven, largely if you were, you know, 20 years ago, if you were getting a 14% ROI, you got a scarcity premium. But when everyone's earning 11, 12, 13, 14 doesn't really matter that much.
Exactly.
But if you're earning 9 and your peers are earning 4, that's a big delta and a massive alpha lever that I think active managers are probably going to be able to monetize, or us included.
I think that's a great way to end this conversation.
Well, thank you for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
Great seeing you as always.
You know I'll do it again.
you want to end with tell folks why you're here?
Sure. As many people know, we are celebrating the 100th anniversary and the centennial of the creation of the mutual fund in America.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's kind of great. And we are having our annual meeting to meet with all the analysts and managers and learn more about what a good job we're doing at MFS from an investment standpoint, but also to celebrate this great creation of this investment product.
You know, maybe for your 2-3 day conference, why don't you just play this podcast and you'll be done with it.
Just get it to me and I'll do that for you.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Ralph.
The views expressed are those of the speaker and are subject to change at any time. These views are for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a recommendation to purchase any security or as an offer of securities or investment advice. No forecast can be guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results.